This is interview with Dr. Fritz Miller, tape 4, side 2. So that in the Zeeman system of just two gyros, body fixed, you have.
Yeah, this is a pitch gyro here.
Uh huh. And
this is parallel to the pitch axis of the missile here.
Right.
Now, this is a longitudinal axis of the missile here. Mm-hmm. You see, when the missile makes a turning around the longitudinal
axis. In other words, roll.
It turns. Yeah. You
know, when it rolls.
It turns automatically that pitch axis around.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the influence on the gyro is not correct anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, this is considering the pitch axis. Now, go back here to the yaw axis and the yaw gyro. This is a yaw gyro, and it is also a roll gyro. So, consider first the yaw gyro. This is the axis of the yaw
mm-hmm.
here in the middle.
Right.
Now, if you have just a yaw motion and introduce a friction here, the gyro will precess around that axis here.
So this is a; these are both 2 degree of freedom gyros,
This is a 2 degree of freedom gyro, which has to stabilize two axes. Mm-hmm. This is also a 2 degree of freedom gyro, which has to stabilize only one axis.
Mm-hmm.
And already this produces an error when the third axis rotates here.
Mm-hmm. So,
but the error is even worse on this one.
On the raw yaw and roll gyro.
Yeah. Right. Let's say here this is the yaw axis. You have a motion around the yaw axis, which produces a torque here on the axis. In consequence of that torque, the gyro makes a precession around that axis here, mm-hmm. which normally doesn't bother you if you have a 1 degree of freedom gyro. Mm-hmm. But if the second axis happens to be the roll axis of the gyro, you turn suddenly the stabilization axis of the roll
mm-hmm.
through a motion of the yaw here.
Mm-hmm. So that when you have a yaw excursion out of what it should be in the yaw,
yeah.
the vehicle, you know, turns essentially the nose goes left and right, relative to the pitch plane, right?
Yeah.
So then the gyro would tend to precess in which direction? Up and down?
It would make a processional motion around the roll axis
mm-hmm.
because the third axis is aligned with the roll axis of the missile.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that if there's a disturbing torque in the yaw direction, it will tend to precess around the roll axis.
Right, it will precess around the roll axis. But in this case, the roll axis is also a stabilization axis for the roll.
Yes.
So you introduce an error.
Mm-hmm. An error in the roll reading.
An error in the roll. And the same thing happens vice versa. You know, if you start roll motion,
mm-hmm.
then you produce an error around the yaw axis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with a lot of technical little tricks, you can make this error effect low. You know, you can put a good friction compensation in, if you have. But even at that time here, where we did not have good servo systems, and before you could put your friction compensation motor in on the yaw axis, you had to have an angle on roll. You know, otherwise you don't have an effect on the torque down there. So
mm-hmm.
you introduce already an angle
mm-hmm.
and roll.
So that you would potentially cause the control system to try to correct for that by rolling in the opposite direction
yeah.
when it wasn't necessary. So
yeah.
you would induce an error so
yeah.
that the vehicle would probably tend just, I mean, with all the compensations and so forth, you can reduce this, but would tend to probably roll a little bit and yaw a little bit out of out of its proper...
you have to, you know, you have to turn a little bit before you can switch your compensation means in, your fixed compensations. And this causes errors. And now assume that you have a rocket which makes little pendulous motions around yaw, you know. You have a constant motion of the roll axis in operation in order to compensate for that in the gyro. And the same thing is vice versa. When you have a motion around roll, you always get little motions around yaw. And since these things go on all the time when you go up there, and you cannot completely control them, you build up an error. You know, an error which goes with time. In generally, it goes linear with time. You know.
Also, I guess in addition to that, if the pitch program is not exactly accurate, unless both roll and yaw are very, very stable, then you introduce a small error in the pitch program. Because then the pitch axis is not quite accurate due to those other motions.
In fact, if the pitch is if the whole thing is a little bit turned, your whole tilt plane, you know, turns around with that gyro because the potentiometer is put on that axis here. So this, and how much that error is in these things depends really on how good your servo systems are and how with how small angles you can pick up a correction torque on the axis and how much disturbance you have while you are flying. This is what it depends on.
And the ability of the control system through the jet vanes and air vanes to respond, how fast it responds, and so forth.
So there are many more errors in than in a stable platform from the very beginning, and you cannot do anything about that. You know, it's in. You can just minimize them as good as it is possible by that time with the means which are available. But here, I think it was acceptable, you know, for the accuracy they required of the system, and so accepted that thing. But when you go out here, let's say, for instance, in a Saturn missile, you know, where you go 200 miles high, and you want to go in orbit, and you don't want to have errors up there, you know, so it is completely different than such a system.
Then you need a truly inertial system.
In for instance, in the Saturn, you know, the Saturn gyro which we built was able to go up, and was even able to make two orbits. You know, it was built for that to make two orbits. And control the thing until the the separation would take place, you know, on the moon trajectory.
Right, after lunar orbit.
So, and this all, that whole part was built completely on the inertial system. All references during that flight, you know, given by the gyros, was due to that status of the gimbal system in the moment of launch. This is what it is built on. And but then came that long flight to the moon, you know, in the Apollo. Yeah. It would be impossible, you know, to make that moon flight, which takes a whole week and includes orbits on the moon and go back, and put it on that reference system, you know, which mm-hmm. you had here.
You mean talking about the inertial, the guide system in the command and service module had to be corrected.
Yeah, the service model. So mm-hmm. what was done there, the service model had its own gyros, you know, mm-hmm. its own gyros. And people think usually, well, fly to the moon, what the gyros might have to do, you know, to fly mm-hmm. to the moon. Well, it would have been impossible. Mm-hmm. With an inertial system, even of our quality, you know, mm-hmm. to make a good moon flight just using that reference system which brought the missile up there. Mm-hmm. Because of the time factor which is in. So they used a simpler gyroscope, somewhat like this single axis, except mm-hmm. they were supported in fluid, you know, this were Treber designed gyros, Treber gyros. And these gyros now did not care about the original reference anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, in fact, they were even switched off, mm-hmm. you know, during the flight when everything was stabilized. And they could be put in again, started again, you know,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah. they made orbits. You through star navigation or from the ground, you would start it over again.
So
you'd create a new reference starting at that point.
Mm-hmm. So some people think, well, this was a real problem out there, you know. Mm-hmm. No, this was not a real problem. The real problem was this here, to bring it up there.
Mm-hmm. And to keep it, the
into that exact
keep that inertial reference on the. Yeah. In the instrument unit of Saturn V for four or 5 hours.
Yeah, these gyros in that Saturn system, they were the most accurate gyros without compensation which were ever used, you know. And they were very close to the Pershing gyros. In that Pershing system, they were a little bit improved by Bendix, but otherwise it was the same thing. And I am pretty sure that the gyros met the accuracy requirements which we had put on by that time already, or early already, that they had drift rates of about a hundredth of a degree per hour, you mm-hmm. know, something like that.
By World War II standards, is incredible improvement.
Well, and mm-hmm. we have not... So far we have not talked about the SG-66 accuracies and so
right.
on.
Right, that's what but, I want to get to.
Mm-hmm. In the SG-66, for instance, in spite of all that efforts which we had made at that time, you know, we had an accuracy of about 4 or 5 degrees per hour. You know, this was what we could produce in the laboratories on accuracy. There were platforms which were better, you know. Sometimes there was one which had one in one axis less than 1 degree per hour. But this was just by incident. You know? Mm-hmm. It was not reliable. The value you could really depend on was 4 or 5 degrees.
Okay.
And even then, there were sometimes, and we didn't know by ZMY, which had suddenly 8 or 10 degrees in one mm-hmm. direction. And a gyro like that Siemens gyro here, I think the best values they might ever have gotten off was about 10 degrees here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I had wanted to understand the whole issue of sort of lateral dispersion and range dispersion in the target. We talked about, you know, the problems that creates with the Siemens system. Effectively, there was no correction for lateral dispersion in the Siemens system,
no,
right?
No, except they made some flights with radar control, you know.
Mm-hmm. Leitstrahl.
Leitstrahl, yes.
Yeah, okay, you have a guide beam.
A kind of radar control.
Okay, so we were talking about the accuracy. As you were saying, there was no correction, at least in for lateral dispersion, except when they tried to use the guide beam to keep the the missile wandering. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
The Siemens system kept the attitude of the missile correct.
The attitude, yeah.
And the either through the Volman system of a radio cutoff or through an accelerometer, they tried to govern the final cutoff velocity. The height adjustment at cutoff was only made by trying to follow a standard trajectory, right? So that could also induce an error. What the actual cutoff velocity was there might be a variation in the height at that cutoff velocity. And they had also they'd also experimented with lateral accelerometers in order to see was that only for attitude control, or was that as well to try to reduce the physical dispersion trajectory?
It was not attitude, it was trajectory control. Mm-hmm. The lateral accelerometer. It would control the trajectory. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The deviations from the prescribed trajectory. If the rocket would go out of the firing plane sidewise, it would produce an acceleration in that direction. And this would be measured by that accelerometer. And I don't know what kind of integrator Schlitt proposed by that time with his accelerometer. I think it was an electrical integration. He proposed the electrical integration. And so the output of the electrical integration would have been the side velocity, the error velocity to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And then he could have given that signal back into the mixing computer and control the rocket back into the flight plane.
But when you're not on a stabilized platform, there must be an extremely complex problem introducing a lot of errors.
You would have to have an accelerometer which is independent in one axis. So that it could be turned around the program axis. If it is independent in one direction, then it could be used. But for simplification, it would be nice to put it on a platform where that problem is not even there.
So with the SG-66 and 70, were you striving for what we call now a fully inertial platform? You couldn't really do that because you didn't have accelerometers in three directions.
By that time we did not consider a fully inertial control system like we are talking about systems today. Today we talk about trajectory control in three components. One forward component, one lateral, and one slant height, or whatever you call it, you know, depending how it is placed in. And this was not planned on the SG-66. The SG-66 was only planned with forward control, trajectory control, forward, with a second integration. And of course, if there would have space, there would have been a little bit space available. If there was an accelerometer which could have measured the lateral, it could have been put on. But it was not in the originally planning.
So you certainly were not planning to have three accelerometers in all three axes.
No. It was not. Not planned.
Well, it could have been done, you know, the space was provided for that, for that accelerometer integrate, and if one would have had three accelerometers, he could have put them on.
But I assume probably you'd also have had the problem that of computing.
Certainly.
It's probably more complex than the equipment could support.
Yeah, you see what difficulties it was to make a second integration in longitudinal direction. We needed a ball and disc integrator, you know, in order to do that. You couldn't have possibly put on three of these things, you know, for three directions. So the integration would have to be performed outside. By electrical means or so.
Electronic, perhaps.
Electronically, which was not possible by that time. At least not when we started the SG-66.
And even Holzer's Mishkarite analog computer probably did not have the capacity to perform such a complex calculations.
Well, he, with a little bit time and so, he probably could have solved it, you know. Of course, it is somewhat different from what he did. He did all his integrations and differentiations only concerning the oscillations of the missile. And here, there would be integrations involved with on a long time basis.
Also, so, the trajectory control problem, yeah, then.
Which would have required some different means, because he made his integrations with capacitors and such elements, and this you can do only for oscillations, but not for a long time. You cannot in a capacitor integrate for a minute or so. At least by that time we couldn't.
So that it wasn't really possible to electronically integrate the error, you know, the corrections for lateral dispersion and distance from planned trajectory.
By that time, it would have been a tremendous difficulty to do that.
This gets me out of the time. It takes me out chronologically, but. Was that, did you solve that problem with analog computers in the 1950s on Army missiles here, on Redstone and Jupiter, not with digital?
The digital came in later on, 55 around, so, you know, the digital came in, and on Pershing there was already some digital, digital involved. But on the Redstone, it was not, it was analog. It was a ball and disc integrator.
Really? And did you integrate then in all three directions for trajectory as well as attitude, or did you,
gaps? In the Redstone we had two directions only. There were two accelerometers, and these were integrating accelerometers, this type.
But
tremendously modified, you know, friction with air bearings, you know, they were used air bearings by that time, and the ball and disc integrators were outside, outside of the platform, in the Redstone missile.
So Jupiter was the first fully inertial system produced here?
You can say Redstone was already the first fully inertial, even if it had only two accelerometers. You know, for the, because the Redstone was a relative short range missile, it was only 200 to 300 miles. So the third accelerometer was not of such an importance. The third accelerometer became very important only for longer ranges. You know, when the flight time gets longer, then it is necessary. So I think the Jupiter was the first one which had three accelerometers on.
Mm-hmm. What was the axis that you did not have an accelerometer on Redstone?
On Redstone,
you did not. What accelerometer could you leave off?
On Redstone, I think the gyros were about a tenth of a degree per hour by that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it could have differed a little bit, you know, but what we really built the thing on and what we figured on and what we were confident we could reach with our pre-tests on the gyros, which we had made all the years before, indicated about a tenth of a degree per hour
mm-hmm.
on this. That was the following thing. When we started 1946 in Fort Bliss, I was already building up a little gyro laboratory in Fort Bliss, and we did not have a real assignment, and the transfer to Huntsville came in 1950. So during this time, what we really did in the gyro laboratory, we just did try to improve the components, to make, you know, to develop frictionless gyros by developing the air bearings further and develop synchronous gyros.
What is that? What is a synchronous gyro? I don't know.
It does not have slip anymore. See, an asynchron gyro should run actually with 30,000 revolutions per minute for a 500 hertz frequency. See? But in reality, it is not synchronous. It does not run synchronous with a rotating field, which is produced by the frequency. So it slips a little bit behind. So the real gyro speed is uncertain in an asynchron gyro. Mm-hmm. Instead of 30,000 revolutions per minute, which is a normal value, it would have been 29,850. Mm-hmm. Or it could have been 29,890 or so. You couldn't say. It was depending on the pretension of the bearings and all such things. So we developed synchronous gyros, which you could depend on the speed, really. If they said 30,000, or here we use 24,000, it was really 24,000. And if you had a computer like this, this is actually a kind of computer, then it is mm-hmm. important, if you want a high accuracy, that you know exactly what the speed is, because the speed goes in.
Mm-hmm.
In a linear way in the computing process.
Mm-hmm. Even when the computer is, as in the case of your accelerometer, a mechanical, electromechanical system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we developed symmetrical gyros. Symmetrical gyros means gyros which do not produce shift of center of gravity when the temperature changes. These old gyros here, when you run them up and they get warm, you know, the rotor shifts a little bit to the side because mm-hmm. the material expands differently and you need different kinds of material in there. So we had symmetrical gyros. This was a main problem, you know, to build symmetrical gyros, synchronous gyros. Then we built, we did a tremendous effort in servo systems here. For instance, on the Redstone, then, we still used magnetic amplifiers, which were huge, heavy things. But the magnetic amplifiers gave us already some better servo systems, more accurate servo systems.
Mm-hmm.
With less reflection into the gyro system.
Mm-hmm.
So we took in consideration that we had a heavy weight, and in fact, the box in the Redstone gyro, which contained the magnetic amplifiers for the servo loops on the gyros was 90 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Just this amplifier box.
Mm-hmm. But this, yeah, again, this is going a little past my understanding. The magnetic amplifiers were to control the servo motors were electric, right? Were
yeah,
they not?
To control
they were electric
servo
motors, but
yeah.
So your problem essentially in designing servo motors is being able to turn have something which responds extremely quickly and accurately. It turns on and off
right.
On an extremely short time scales.
Right? On a short time scale and produce mm-hmm. finally the current which will operate the motor. You
mm-hmm.
know? Your amplification system must be able to produce a few amps output, you know, on a whatever your voltage is, on 24 volts or so, in order to operate that motor.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot have a quick servo motor without a real push behind, you know, electric push.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a problem, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When we used a conduct like this here, well, you could easily...
You mean on the... okay, again, on tape, we can't see this. So you're pointing to the mm-hmm. to the German
yeah.
accelerometer.
When you use the on and off conduct,
mm-hmm.
you could switch one amp or so, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you did not have that, how could you produce a few amps which you needed in the motor in
mm-hmm.
order to drive that thing? And this was done then by the magnetic amplifier. It's in principle like a tube amplifier. You put a small current in or a small voltage and you get a higher voltage or a higher current out in order
mm-hmm.
to drive that motor. And there were no transistors by that time.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. So you had...
And another problem, of course, was the pickup itself. You know, you needed a variable pickup on the gyro or whatever it was. So first, I remember we used a little airstream, which was directed, we called this a bolometer, which was directed at two resistance wires.
Mm-hmm.
And the resistance wires were close to each other, and the airstream could go between them in the zero position. And when the gyro moved, then the airstream cooled the one wire or cooled the other wire.
Mm-hmm.
And the wire was cooled, you had a change in voltage, you know, in your circuit. And then with that change in voltage, you could operate magnetic amplifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And but this was not a satisfying thing. It was only a temporary, you know, solution. And then later on, we used this inductive starter to use inductive pickups,
mm-hmm.
which are essentially transformers, where the one part of the transformer moves a little bit when the gyro turns. And creates a, induces a voltage in the other coil. And you have two coils, you know, so that you induce a voltage here
mm-hmm.
or induce a voltage on the other one. These are called inductive pickups, and they are the pickups which are used today.
Mm-hmm.
Such inductive pickups and rectifiers and amplifiers, all what you have available to do in transistors.
Mm-hmm. And now beyond that in integrated circuits.
You have it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you do it with
miniaturization.
With very small voltages today in the
mm-hmm.
integrated circuit. The integrated
mm-hmm.
circuit really makes it possible that you can notice already the slightest motions of a gyro.
Mm-hmm.
You do not have to go out half a degree before you get a voltage on your pickup. You have it when you go out a hundredth today or even
mm-hmm.
less. Because you have to operate only milliamps and millivolts in such systems. And then you amplify behind the integrated circuit.
Mm-hmm.
In the integrated circuit, you can also do your mixing easily, without.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's a completely different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is in the course. This helps me a lot, just because I'm not really working on that period, but it enables me to understand where the technology was in 1940, or what errors you were dealing with and what problems you were dealing with when I compare it to what we have, you know, today, and what was developed in the United States.
Yeah, Ben, for instance, I remember one thing. There was a distance meter on ships, you know, and the distance meter had a basis of about 10 meter,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the two optical rays came out. And you could, of course, observe another ship only if that distance meter was stabilized in such a way that it didn't make the motions of the ship. You know, if you looked at another object, you wondered that the ship could make motions without that distance meter making the same motions, you know, the
mm-hmm.
angular motions. And so you had to stabilize that thing. Today, well, somebody would take a small gyro and build a nice servo loop and put a large motor on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And stabilize it by a motor. And
mm-hmm.
if it is done right, you wouldn't even notice a motion, you know. It would mm-hmm. be wonderful. But by that time, things like that were not possible. So we put on large gyros, which were so powerful that they could hold that thing by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And these gyros were more than 50 centimeters in diameter, which is a half meter.
Yeah.
Can you imagine such a thing?
Yeah, it's a 1.5.
Yeah.
1.5 feet or more than 1.5 feet in diameter is gyros.
Yeah.
So the gyros were, for the Navy purposes at that time,
very, very
large and heavy.
Such a gyro was maybe 400 or 500 pounds.
Mm-hmm. The rotor on the gyro. mm-hmm. The bearing problem, friction, and all of these gyros that you've been talking about in the German era were all ball bearing.
Yeah,
gyros.
They were all ball bearing.
Had you explored, researched the possibility of air bearing or liquid bearings during the war?
Yes, we had. Let's say we had started in 1944, but it was insignificant in comparison to what we did later on here, you know. It was almost nothing, really. On air-bearing developments, what I had done were only the bearings which were used in that overground compass, which I mentioned, where Gieves was so much interested in, and they were relative primitive in comparison to our later air bearings. But they were not exposed to high accelerations or so. So they were just made so that they were running without friction. They had certainly disturbing torques by that time, which came from the airstream. It was compressed air which was used. And we were in a status that we did not even care about these little torques which were produced
mm-hmm.
at that time as disturbance torques. And then I did go one step further. I made a design, actually, of a SG-66, which contained three gyros which were supported in air bearings. And it was the first time that I really gave a little bit form to an air bearing. I built the air bearing around the whole gyro, like it is done today, you know. It was a cylindrical, like a can, so to say, the gyro was in a can, like a beer can,
mm-hmm.
and around that can was an air bearing sleeve, around the mm-hmm. whole thing, with two side plates. But at that time, I could not consider, and I did not consider, dimensional stabilities, you know, and how such a thing would operate later on, and how effective it would be, and whether it was able to carry a few G's, to carry the gyro under the load of a few G's. It was just a laboratory model. And because of these air-bearing sleeves, which had to be put around there, I had to deviate from the normal gyros, from the gyro angular momentum, which, and had to use a much smaller gyro. So the angular momentum and that of that gyro in comparison to the SG66 gyro was 50 to 7. So much reduction was required in angular momentum, mm-hmm. from 50 to 7.
Mm-hmm. What and units are you talking about when you say 50 and 7?
50 million
mm-hmm.
Angular momentum, you know, centimeter gram second, mm-hmm. you know, is a dimension. And this was reduced to 7. So it was
7 million?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a...
About 1/7, only, in other words, about 1/7 the angular momentum.
1/7. Mm-hmm. And this would have led to an oscillation in the platform, you know. It would mm-hmm. never have been a stable platform without having a much better servo system. But we did not have a better servo system by that time. And when in 1944, this thing was built by the end of 1944. And if it would have been tested really, you know, if we had had the time to go ahead, it would have been absolutely necessary by that time to produce a better servo loop, you know, for this
thing. Mm-hmm.
And this was true in particular since the air bearing, at least the air bearings by that time, did not have the stiffness of ball bearings, for instance. So the air bearing introduced an elastic member
mm-hmm.
in the whole stabilization loop of a gyroscope or of a stabilized platform. And this would have been another tremendous drawback, you know. So it would have required improvements in servo loops. But in spite of that, I did it, and the instrument was standing there, and I can say I built the first
mm-hmm.
stabilized platform with an air bearing, mm-hmm. but it would never have been able to fly
mm-hmm. in
that condition.
As far as you are aware, was that the first air bearing experiment in the world, or?
This I can say. I don't.
In Germany?
I don't. I believe. Yeah, I might say, but
your microphone fell down.
We did not have too much insight in what other companies did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was secret during the war in Germany. So I don't know what other companies really, really did. But I believe that our companies was ahead in that respect. And this in particular, because of Boyko's original idea with that overground compass mm-hmm. and Giewe's idea to follow up on that thing. And the drawback why it never worked was that you did not have friction-free bearings, you know, which these systems really require.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was instrumental, you know, in helping and developing the first air bearings for that miniaturized system which he had in mind there.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, the outgrowth then was that I switched over and used it in the stabilized platform and made and design improvements and try to make it possible. Dr. Kievers had for years tried to develop liquid supports, you know, water bearings. And he was successful in one instrument, which was a Noorseeking gyroscope. And this operated really on water bearings and was also used. I think it was used later on by the German army, even for finding Noor's directions in.
Better stop here. We've run through yet another tape.